Bob, we have the plans, he said. And maybe that was a lie. He couldn't know for sure, but he was too desperate to care. They found the Death Star plans. They have to transmit them from the communications tower. He heard voices in the background, bridge officers maybe, debating how to respond. Bodhi powered through. You have to get in position, get ready to receive, and you have to take down the shield gate. It's the only way to get through. For an achingly long time, there was no answer.
Copy you, Rogue One,
the voice finally said.
We'll get it done.
Then, directed not to Bodhi, but to someone else on the bridge,
call in a Hammerhead Corvette. I have an idea.
The signal went dead. It didn't matter to Bodhi. He'd said what he needed to say. The blaster fire outside had stopped. The silence was almost peaceful. Hands trembling, Bodhi straightened behind the console and glanced from the boarding ramp to the cockpit ladder. He thought of his plan to take off, to fly through the gauntlet of ties to rescue Jin and Cassian from the communications tower. He thought of the strain he'd heard in Cassian's voice and of his last signal to Melshi, the one that had gone unanswered. If he didn't have the chance, he'd done enough. It was okay. This is for you, Galen, he said, and started for the ladder. Bodhi Rook heard the ring of metal once, twice in the cabin, and then the soft clatter of something rolling across the deck. He turned in time to glimpse the detonator. He heard nothing as the cabin flared impossibly bright. Like a pilot should, he died with his ship. Bay's mouth was cradled with the last true guardian of the wheels in his arms and answered Chirrut's dying words. The Force is with me, Bay said, and I am one with the Force. A flare rose in the distance. Something was burning on landing pad 9. In all likelihood, Bodhi Rook 2 was gone. Gone before he had ever sent his message. Gone and rendering Chirrut's sacrifice pointless. Once again, the Empire had stolen meaning from Baze. He might have screamed, if not for the man he held.
The Force is with me, he repeated. And I am with the Force.
Did he believe the words? Did it matter? Had it ever mattered? The stormtrooper's perimeter was intact. They'd momentarily drawn back after murdering Chirrut, away from the smoke of the explosion. Now, they were closing again, sweeping their rifle scopes toward Baze. Their action seemed interminably slow, as if time had become Baze's tormentor, so that he might suffer the anguish of a lifetime in a second. He spoke the words, and in them, he found not comfort, but conviction. Or the memory of conviction, as if the words were a key to the forgotten faith of his youth. The unlocked memory strangled him, racking and intense. He knew again the significance of the Force, in every breath and action, knew all he had forsaken in years past, saw the vast gulf between the guardian he had been and the man he was now, and wept in his heart for both. He gently laid the body down and raised his cannon, identified a trooper who was tensing to fire. He sent an energy blast through the trooper's chest and sent him reeling into sand and dirt. As the rest of the squad returned the fusillade, Bay squeezed his trigger, held it, and let his generator scream and his weapon writhe and buck. He alternated swift bursts and raging, aimless streams with precision killings. He advanced on the men and women who had taken his past, his home, his friend, his hope, his faith. But he did not stray far from Chirrut. He had nowhere to go. He would not leave Chirrut now. He recognized the pain he had felt before, the hot, half-numb agony of a blaster bolt, his nerves obliterated at the epicenter of the wound and screaming around the corona. He fell to his knees and forced himself to rise again.
His body was caked in ash and sweat, and he stank of burning hair, and he embraced the nightmare. Raged with shot after shot, until he had surely slain 100 or 1,000 stormtroopers. It was not enough. It could never be enough to restore Chirrut or the years he'd lost. They saw a dying trooper fumble for a grenade and lob it in his direction. The grenade would land short of its target, but Baze could barely stumble forward, let alone run for cover. He wrenched himself about, craned his neck to see Chirrut one last time. When death had come for him in the shadow of the walker, he had faced it with defiance. Now, there was grief. There was no fear. Baze Malbus died in pain, but it did not last long. Rogue One was alive. Jyn Erso had the Death Star schematics, and in those schematics was the chance to save the Alliance. A chance to save Mon Cala. There was no price Admiral Raddus would refuse to pay to see that chance realized. With the disabling of one Star Destroyer, the tide of battle above Scarif had turned. Yet while the advantage belonged to the Alliance fleet, bombardment of the orbital gate station uncovered no weakness in either the field or the station itself. A prolonged siege might result in victory, but Raddus didn't doubt enemy reinforcements were en route. Massive firepower might break the gate open, but the Alliance's fiercest warships lacked the catastrophic might of the Empire's. In silently articulating the dilemma, the solution had become apparent to Raddus. He had laid out his plan to his officers, and they had not questioned him. But even to Raddus's tastes, the price was high. He had chosen the Hammerhead Lightmaker and its captain, Cato O'Quone, to implement his vision. O'Quone's ship had been badly damaged after being flanked by the twin destroyers, and had since withdrawn from the field of fire to guard the line of retreat. For these reasons, it would serve Raddus's purpose.
"Are you prepared, Captain?"
He spoke to O'Quone from the bridge of the Profundity, his eyes fixed on his tactical display.
"Non-essential personnel have evacuated,"
O'Quone replied.
"It's just me, a skeleton crew, and a handful of droids. Course is locked."
His voice did not tremble. Raddus gave him credit for that. When he'd explained his intent, O'Quone had reacted angrily, yet only for an instant. Since that moment, the captain had been nothing but resolved.
"Then begin,"
Raddus said. The comm went silent. The Lightmaker's engines pulsed as the great vessel turned, first away from the battle, then back in a wide arc, adjusting its trajectory by fractions of a meter as it went. Raddus had not demanded that O'Quone and his chosen few remain aboard. But such precise work was best left with organics instead of droids alone. O'Quone knew it as well as Raddus. The swarm of Alliance starfighters around the second surviving Star Destroyer formed a loose cordon, locking the vessel in place as larger rebel ships disengaged. These actions would leave both fighters and command ships vulnerable to TIE counterattacks, but Raddus had deemed that price acceptable as well. The Lightmaker picked up speed as it approached the fray, pulled by Scarif's gravity as it pushed with its engines toward the disabled destroyer. The second Star Destroyer seemed to realize what was happening, but much too late. Caged by red and gold squadron fighters, it could go nowhere in time to escape its fate. Raddus watched the Lightmaker descend like a spear into the mass of the disabled behemoth. Metal sheared and crumpled, and Raddus feared for a moment that O'Quone's velocity had been too great, that the Lightmaker would be dashed to nothingness, and the most delicate part of the plan, still to come, had failed. Yet the destroyer absorbed the impact and began to tumble away, its frame marred but intact. He spotted the motes of escape pods against the stars. He did not dare hope that they had come from the Lightmaker. The disabled Star Destroyer drifted toward its caged twin. O'Quone's course had been set with precision. As the Alliance starfighters broke away, the two destroyers collided.
Both ships flared with destructive power, and both tumbled more swiftly as Scarif's gravity gripped them. Locked together by cataclysmic devastation, their entwined wreckage plummeted toward the inner ring of the orbital gate station. Where the Star Destroyers struck the energy field, the shield shimmered and radiated and finally broke, dissipating like foam on the crest of a wave. "Get us into geostationary orbit above the Citadel now!" Radus cried. "All fighters, move to defend the profundity! We must be in position to receive that transmission!" The TIE fighters would concentrate on his flagship once the Empire recognized his intent. But in truth, he didn't need to hold out long. The shield gate would regenerate swiftly enough. Rogue One's window of opportunity to transmit would be narrow. And if it closed, there would be no other. Silently, Radus pledged to name his great-grandchildren after O'Quone and the crew of the Lightmaker. Then he clasped his hands together to await word from Jyn Erso. Chapter 21. Cassian was dead, along with how many others, Jyn didn't know. The man in white, who had been there for the worst moments of her life, was present again. The darkness enveloped her, broken by the thousand red eyes of the data cartridges. Her arms trembled violently every time she pulled herself higher, as if ready to wrench loose from their sockets. But she could see light above her. Climb! Her gloves were soaked in sweat turned cold by the data vault's refrigeration. Wedging her boots into narrow footholds over and over had left her toes numb from compression. The cartridge on her belt felt heavy enough to drag her down below the crust of Scarif. She could see the pulsing aperture in the ceiling clearly now. A series of vents opened and shut in sequence, suctioning the warmest air from the tower. It seemed to buoy her as it wafted free. Climb! She caught glimpses of blue sky. She was at the top of the data stack, close enough to the first vent to put her arm through. She pictured herself making the attempt and being crushed and bloodied and broken by the pulsing door. For a single despairing moment, she couldn't bear the thought of another climb. Then the moment passed, and she counted 1, 2, 3 to time the movements of the vents. Lyanna Halleck and Tanith and Kestrel, old names, old lives, had done braver, bolder things than this. Jyn Erso could too. She scrambled through a vent, leapt to the next, climbed and waited. Resting was as agonizing as motion. While she paused between apertures, counting seconds, her muscles begged for momentum or eternal stillness, not a torturous stop and go. 1, 2, 3, go! Wait, 2, 3. She barely noticed the air turn from frigid to warm, the balmy humidity moistening her lips and throat. 1, 2, 3, go! Then there was nowhere for her to climb, and she was sprawled on metal plating, the surface uncomfortably hot in the sunlight as she crawled forward. She was out of the data vault. Out of the dark. She lacked the strength to feel triumphant. She forced herself to stand, fumbled at her blaster as she searched for stormtroopers, for black-clad killers or the man in white. But she was alone atop the tower, on a broad platform in the shadow of an enormous antenna dish. Her knees knocked as she surveyed the bright sky, dense with white clouds that met the sea at the horizon. The serenity was marred by the scream of starfighters, cannons blazing in fiery red and sickly green as rebel pursued Imperial and Imperial pursued rebel. The smell of ashes rose from somewhere far below. Yet she was alone. "You don't have long," she told herself, and coaxed her body into motion. She spotted a control panel built into the outer railing across from a turbo lift and hobbled over to it, trying to kick life back into her legs. She didn't recognize the layout. It looked like a comm terminal, but there was no audio input and a dozen toggles she didn't recognize. She found a slot for a data cartridge, however. Half disbelieving, she probed it with her fingers before loading the Stardust tape. The screen flashed with options and technical jargon. An authoritative electronic voice repeated sternly,
"Reset antenna alignment."
She swore and slammed a fist against the panel. She wanted to kick K2SO for sending her here. Kick him until the droid fell to pieces. And immediately she felt sick with guilt at the image. Back aching, she leaned in to examine the screen. She wasn't even sure what she was looking for. Had K2SO configured the dish to send to the fleet? Had Bodhi, if he'd made contact? Was the shield down, so the antenna had to be reset in response? She didn't know, and the panel didn't tell her. But images flashed on the screen indicating another control unit off a catwalk extending from the tower platform. Fine. We'll reset the antenna alignment. She wasn't going to be the woman who doomed the Alliance because she couldn't figure out a damn comm panel. Clutching her blaster tight, she made her way to the catwalk and spotted the cylindrical control unit rising at the far end. The wind sent her swaying as she stepped to the plank, and the guardrails looked much too low to do any good. She hurried to the unit, found a dial, and turned it awkwardly between her fingers, one way and then the next, until the voice announced again,
"Dish aligning."
She heard servos grind and turned to see the great antenna dish in motion. It rose and adjusted until it pointed straight overhead.
"Dish aligned. Ready to transmit."
Please be right. She started back along the catwalk. The shriek of a TIE fighter rose on the wind, but at first she ignored it. Then the vessel itself swept into view, descending toward the platform with its great cockpit eye fixed on her. She froze, unsure whether to run or to drop to the catwalk in the hope of hiding. She ran, and the fighter's cannons pulsed. Emerald light and fire stained her vision. The catwalk undulated like a flag in the wind, then dropped away altogether. The sound of ripping metal filled her ears as shrapnel tore at her legs and sleeves. Her face felt like it was aflame. She reached out desperately, felt her fingers close around something. The remnants of a guardrail, or the underside of the twisted and dangling plank. And she screamed, a breathless, silent scream, as the muscles in her overtaxed shoulders seemed to tear. The broken catwalk swung haltingly in the wind. Jin clung as tight as she could and tried to slither upward as her sight began to return. Through a smeared and smoky filter, she made out the blackened edge of the platform, barely an arm's length away. Climb! There were no data cartridge handles this time. No convenient footholds. The burning and sun-baked metal felt blisteringly hot against Jin's body. She dragged herself upward a centimeter, a millimeter at a time, as the wind tried to prise her fingers free. She was close enough to touch the rim of the platform when she felt a shadow pass over her. She raised her eyes from the catwalk and saw a smudge against the blue sky that she tried to blink away. Her eyes stung as ash mixed with tears, but the smudge only grew clearer. A perfect gray sphere hung high above the planet, its surface etched with lines like circuitry. She hadn't seen it on Jeddah. Not really. Not in the state she'd been. But she recognized it anyway. Knew it with her subconscious mind and felt no surprise. The Death Star had come to Scarif. The deck shuddered lovingly as the battle station dropped out of light speed. Dozens of objects flashed onto the overbridge's tactical displays. Imperial and rebel vessels in conflict throughout the system. And Will of Tarkin made his assessment after seconds of perusal. The Empire was losing over Scarif, but that was about to change. Duty officers called out status reports for their assigned sections of the Death Star. The hyperspace journey had gone smoothly, and the station was ready for war. Its gunners and fighter pilots were at full alert. More Imperial ships were on their way.
Sir, shall I begin targeting their fleet?
There was proud enthusiasm in General Ramodi's voice. Tarkin looked at the old warhorse, then shook his head. It might be amusing, even illuminating, to test the station's capabilities against a rebel armada, but now was not the day to toy with the enemy. Director Krennic, General Ramda, and Admiral Gorin had all failed to solve the problem at hand, granting the rebels opportunity after opportunity to seize the schematics from the Citadel. At last report, the data vault itself had been breached. It was a show of incompetence so great that Tarkin was almost curious to know how Krennic might explain it away. Almost curious. No. Best to start fresh, to eliminate the threat of the rebels, however slight, and clear away the dead wood of the Imperial military.
Lord Vader will handle the fleet, Tarkin said. The plans must not be allowed to leave Scarif at any cost.
Ramodi understood.
Yes, sir,
he replied, and began calling orders to his aides. Tarkin looked to the viewscreen and to Scarif. An ocean-drenched sphere of islands rich with rare metals, useful as a construction outpost and research incubator away from the Senate's prying eyes. But Tarkin would not miss it. Over the years, too many officers had treated it as a place for unofficial retirement, a tropical paradise where they could neglect their duty and comfort. The loss of the Citadel and the planetary shield would be a pity, but no more than that.
Single reactor ignition, Tarkin said. You may fire when ready.
Orson Krennic turned his pistol over in his left hand, tracing the ridges of the grip through his glove. He rarely ever drew the weapon. His custom DT-29, maintained with exquisite care over the years, but he had chosen it for the brutal force it delivered in a single shot. It was a killing tool, meant to end a foe at close quarters. The circumstances in the vault had negated its effectiveness, even as death troopers had been unable to fell the woman. Her accomplice didn't concern him. The man was a stranger, and a dead one at that. But the woman, she'd looked at him. From her perch among the data cartridges, with wide eyes full of mockery and hatred, she'd looked at Krennic. The same woman who had come for him on Edu, who had, he did not doubt, received Galen Erso's message on Jeddah and escaped the destruction of the Holy City. She had recognized him, and he now felt with wrenching certainty that he had seen her long before her infiltration of the research facility. He could not say when or where, but he knew. Whoever she was, Galen had selected her to be his vengeance from beyond the grave, turned her into his weapon. Krennic wanted to scream at Erso, to rage at the injustice of a dead man placing fresh obstacles in his path. You were a hypocrite and a coward in life. There is no changing that now. But exorcising Galen would require more than words. So Krennic rode the maintenance turbo lift to the top of the communications tower, where he might put an end to the man's last act of sabotage. As it approached the top, the lift shuddered violently, and its lights went dim. Krennic nearly dropped his pistol as he set a palm against the wall for balance. The carriage had halted. Once it steadied, he raised a fist to strike the door before thinking better of the choice. He did not know how precarious his situation was. He activated the control panel comlink and adjusted its settings.
General! He snapped. What's going on at the top of the tower?
He heard multiple voices murmur in swift consultation before one of Ramda's lieutenants finally answered.
Minor damage from the aerial battle director. Do you require assistance?
I've already signaled my security team,
Krennic growled. He regretted sending so much of his detail to the battlefield, but the deed was done.
and he'd chosen not to wait for them outside the data vault. Get me full power to the lift immediately! Even if his foe had retrieved the DS-1 technical schematics, she would surely be unable to beam them to a ship in orbit. There was nothing she could do. Yet Krennic found little consolation in that thought.
At once, sir. Also, we haven't received an update from Admiral Gorin.
Krennic snarled and prepared to close the link. Before he could, Ramda broke in.
Visual confirmation! The Death Star has entered orbit! The rebel fleet is doomed!
Heat rose up Krennic's face. His Death Star had been commandeered. But if it had come to assist against the rebels, Ramda was right. Nothing the Alliance could field could possibly stand against the battle station. If it had come to assist, an alternative crossed Krennic's brain that he did not wish to contemplate. As the lights flickered on, he severed the link and reactivated the lift. The carriage hummed into motion, then quickly jolted to a stop. He gripped his pistol and squared his shoulders. The Death Star's presence was one more reason to put a halt to Galen's interference. He stepped out onto the platform to kill the last of the Jedi survivors and silenced Lyra's inexplicable taunting inside his head. You'll never win. Clinging to the ruined catwalk, Jin stared at the planet killer lodged in the bright sky. Cassian was dead. K2SO was gone. Bodhi and Chirrut and Baze might have been alive, but it was hard to imagine anyone surviving the war zone she saw below the tower. No one had called her comlink for a long while. If she wasn't the last of the men and women who'd come from Yavin 4, she suspected she was close to it. She'd done better than most. It would take the Empire a whole battle station to end her. With ragged, whimpering breaths, she shimmied up the last stretch of the catwalk. She wrapped her legs tight around metal to steady herself, then raised one gloved hand and slapped the rim of the platform, working sore and half-numb fingers until she located a grip. She mirrored the motion with her other arm and forced torn muscles to pull her weight up, up, and over the edge until she was on her knees on steady ground and quivering from the effort. When she looked at the sky again, the Death Star was still there. Kill me, you bastard, she thought, because there's nothing I can do to stop you. Maybe her mission to Scarif had been doomed from the start. Maybe she'd even known it. But the Death Star made it impossible to pretend. She had been afraid of losing her way. Afraid that fearing for her allies would distract her. Afraid that losing her allies would regress her to the survivor she'd been all her life. Ready to abandon everything she'd come to Scarif for. Now, surviving wasn't an option, and no one was left as a distraction. Her fears had been laughably naive. Nauseated and racked with pain, she took greedy gulps of air and waited to see what would come. By the time she felt she could move again, the Death Star still hadn't killed her. She realized nothing had changed. Nothing. The thing that had brought her to Scarif, not her father, not her comrades, not some impulse buried below the cave, but the monstrosity that killed and killed and killed until every little girl and pilgrim and mother in the galaxy was dead, was staring down at her as real as ever. Her mission was the same. She just had less time to finish. She propped herself on one leg and rose to a stand. The platform sputtered with flame where the TIE's cannons had struck, and ashes wafted in dense clouds between Jin and the control panel. She took a tottering step and lurched to a stop as a silhouette appeared in the smoke. A man in a cape. The man in white. Not now. Not now! The Death Star was, for all its apocalyptic might, a comprehensible threat. A machine built by her father to kill planets. The man in white was a nightmare. An impossible creature that had followed her across her life. She reached for her blaster, but she dropped the weapon off the catwalk. It was somewhere in pieces at the base of the tower. The man in white was alone. He held a pistol in one black-gloved hand and aimed steadily at Jin's chest. Eyes the same color as the ash that drifted around him fixed on her with a strange mixture of rage and bafflement. Jin parted her lips, unable to speak, barely able to keep from shaking in terror or fury or both. "Who are you?" he asked. He had ruined her father and killed her mother and killed Cassian. He had stolen her home and forced her into the arms of Saw Gerrera. He had whittled her with a knife out of a block of flesh. She almost screamed, "How can you ask that?" But as the words penetrated and the implications heated her skin, she met those wild eyes. His breathing was haggard, and not merely from the smoke. "Who are you?" he repeated. His hand twitched. The blaster barrel jerked up to point at Jin's collar. He was afraid. He was not the Empire. Not every moment of oppression and indignity and torment she had ever suffered. He was an Imperial. A petty, spiteful, scared little man who'd forgotten his own atrocities. And he didn't know her at all. She decided to make him remember. "You know who I am," she said. And though her body felt brittle, her voice was steady. "I'm Jin Erso, daughter of Galen and Lyra." She couldn't remember ever saying that before, let alone with pride. The man in white stared. "The child," he finally said. "The child," Jin agreed. She tried to shrug. The agony in her shoulders kept her from lifting them. He straightened his firing arm. She couldn't rush him. Couldn't possibly close the distance and disarm him, not in her condition. Not without a delay or a distraction. Panic and wild indignation rose inside her at the prospect of this man, diminished or not, bringing about her ultimate failure. But she tamped it down. If she could control her fear, she could control his, too. "You've lost," she told him. If she could keep him from shooting, her opportunity might come. And if he was going to kill her, if she couldn't claw his face or punch him in the gut or put a blaster to his skull, if he stopped her mission, loosed the Death Star in the galaxy, she would damn well make him never forget her again.
"Oh, I have I?"
the man in white asked, unctuous and cruel. He didn't lower his weapon. He didn't shoot either. "My father's revenge," Jin said. She resisted the urge to sneer. Her voice came out proud and defiant. "He built a flaw in the Death Star. He put a fuse in the middle of your machine. And I've just told the entire galaxy how to light it." The man in white scowled. His head twitched toward the great communications dish. "This is your chance. Go. Go." But her legs wouldn't move. If she leapt at him now, she'd sprawl on the platform, utterly defeated. "The shield is up!" the man in white snarled. He was burying his fear of her, beneath patronizing disdain and venom. "Your signal will never reach the rebel base." Maybe he was right. But he couldn't know. "Your shield is..." He cut her off, enraptured by his own words. "I've lost nothing but time. You, on the other hand, will die with the rebellion." He checked his aim. Jin prepared a desperate lunge. She wouldn't die. Refused to die holding still. If he caught her in the side, maybe she could stop him, crawl the rest of the way to the control panel, and transmit with her last breath. She planned it, fantasized it. Yet, when the blast came, she wasn't ready. She heard The electric echo of the bolt ripped the air. She saw the man in white drop to his knees and fall prone. His expression, nothing short of astonished. A black hole was burned in the fabric of his ivory cape. Like that, her nightmare was over. Behind the man in white, stepping out of the smoke, came a bloody and limping Cassian Andor. He looked like a man who'd fallen 12 stories and clawed his way back to the top. He looked as beautiful as anyone Jin had ever known. But she couldn't spare a moment to even shout his name. Instead, she ran. Somehow she ran, thinking through the motion of each leg and certain she would slip on the platform. Certain, too, she would scrabble up again and keep running. She tried to draw a lungful of air and found her mouth and nostrils raked by burning cinders. She heard a distant rumble, an explosion from a faraway battle, and pushed on. Soon her hands were on the control panel, fumbling as she looked to the screen in incomprehension. She forced herself to slow, to focus. She pulled the broadcast lever. She watched the screen flash. She couldn't read it through the haze, but she heard the voice.
Transmitting.
Her breath came in racked, tearless sobs of relief and elation. She had to grip the panel to keep from falling, as vertigo, stronger than anything she'd suffered in her climbs, overtook her. She wanted to shout, but she lacked the strength. She wanted to laugh at the heavens, at the fleet and the Death Star, but she lacked the strength for that too. Instead, she turned to Cassian, who still waited in the smoke. She stumbled to him, smiling like a child, and did not speak. Chapter 22.
Admiral! Receiving a transmission from Scarif!
The profundity trembled under the onslaught of TIE fighters. Its shields burst, reformed, and burst again as Emerald Volley struck. Three decks had already been forced to evacuate due to radiation leakage. But the profundity endured where other vessels had been torn apart. In geostationary orbit above the Scarif Citadel, it was the center of a storm of molten metal and rent ships. The Death Star had not turned its weapons against the Rebel fleet, but it carried enough fighter squadrons to swiftly achieve battlefield supremacy. Admiral Raddus was not prone to awe or terror, yet he had not imagined the scale of the horror he faced. Thus, he knew wonder at the words of his comm officer.
Confirm!
Raddus snapped, and hit his knee as best he could.
Checking the data, came the reply. We have the plans!
She did it, Raddus hissed. The deck lurched, and he caught his balance barely noticed. He watched his displays and began issuing orders to reconfigure the fleet.
The battle station, sir,
his lieutenant called.
Massive energy buildup.
Raddus cut his man off with a gesture. Jin Erso had made the station's power clear on Yavin 4. Stopping it over Scarif was a task for nobler fools than he.
Rogue One! May the Force be with you, he said.
Then he straightened and inhaled a mouthful of humid air.
All ships, he cried. Prepare for jump to hyperspace!
He made a show of confidence for his people, but he saw the tactical display flicker and register a new vessel entering the system. A third Star Destroyer had finally arrived. In a haze of smoke like thunderheads, Orson Krennic searched his memories for a time before he had met Galen Erso. He thought back to Edu, to the squeal of wet boots on metal and his attempts to commiserate with the scientist in the early days after Lyra's death, his efforts to soothe Galen regarding the fate of his daughter, and to remind him of the magnificence of the work. He thought back further to Coruscant, where he'd been inspired to pluck Galen out of obscurity for Project Celestial Power. He thought to the games he'd been forced to play, knowing Lyra's provincial interests would distract Galen from his focus. Back still further, to the Futures program, when he'd drawn Galen into his circle and recognized with wonder, not jealousy, but unadulterated wonder, the galaxy-changing potential of the man's genius. And before then, he could follow Galen Erso's thread through his life. He could see the full extent of the tragedy. The waste of effort on a wasted man. But what about before? He sought refuge in his childhood, tried to recall an Orson whose hopes had not yet been cast in shadow. Instead, he heard a peal of thunder, and he raised his chin and left his memories and saw that the thunder was the roar of fire atop the Scarif Calm Tower. His body was full of pain. He found he could move his limbs if he ignored their weight. He dragged himself forward. For what purpose? He wasn't entirely sure. Survival? The work? The child! He gasped thin, whistling gasps as he tried to rise, failed, crawled forward a few more meters. He looked for the child, for Jin Erso, but she was gone. He raised himself higher, rolled back his eyes until his skull hurt, and recognized the penumbra of the Death Star in the sky. It was Will of Tarkin who had commandeered his battle station. Tarkin alone would have the arrogance. Tarkin alone would have the spite to loom over Scarif and threaten the wellspring of all his own triumphs. The Death Star's focusing dish glittered with emerald light. Krennic's fury built in key with the station's energies and sought purpose, an outlet, a target. But Krennic's body was ruined. His enemies were far from him. He had no one to command and no one to master, no one to sway into sharing his vision for the future, or the Empire, or his personal aggrandizement. My father's revenge. Krennic was doomed then, though it galled him to admit it. Yet while he might die at Tarkin's hands, he would die in the fires of his creation. The Death Star would endure. He licked blood and spittle from his lips, and imagined world after world consumed by his station's power. Even the Emperor would not leave such a mark on the galaxy. The Death Star, his Death Star, would alter star systems and civilizations, be remembered 1,000 generations after Tarkin had been erased from history. And while Tarkin did live, he would know that every victory he eked out would be due to Krennic's work. He would fumble his way through battle after battle, not truly understanding the weapon he wielded, until his arrogance destroyed him. He built a flaw in the Death Star. The focusing dish glowed brighter. Krennic squeezed his eyes shut and used the last glimmerings of his mind to see the station as it was meant to be seen, to stand on the overbridge of his behemoth creation, listen to the reactor's muffled roar turn to a shriek, feel the tremors in the deck plating turn violent as the Kyber core exerted its strength. Jin Erso had given her life to steal the Death Star schematics, but those schematics were etched in his heart. You'll never win. He would die not on Scarif, but inside the Death Star. And as he envisioned the cataclysmic energies building within the vast station, he saw it. A detail he had overlooked and forgotten. Some trivial adjustment of Galen's. A single exhaust port leading from a narrow trench down and down, down kilometers of blackness, past conduits and hatches and radiation plating, down and down and into the main reactor. The primary weapon of the Death Star battle station fired. Orson Krennic, Advanced Weapons Research Director and father of the Death Star, died alone on Scarif, screaming in fury at Galen Erso, at Jin Erso, at Will of Tarkin, and at all the galaxy. The last time Cassian had hurt so bad, K2SO had carried him to a safe house, and along the way, enumerated his every injury, thoroughly assessed the likelihoods of infection and permanent nerve damage. It had been the droid's way of showing he cared, or at least the droid's way of showing he was invested in his master's fate. K2SO hadn't been there for Cassian at the top of the Citadel communications tower, but Jin had turned to him from the control panel, looking like the last survivor of a war, and she'd smiled in a way he'd never seen before. It hadn't been a smile predicated on anticipation or courage, or one touched by sadness or doubt. Just a smile so ordinary, it seemed to change Jin from a hero out of myth into a woman he might have known and understood. He hadn't known her. Didn't know her, of course. There wasn't the time. She'd half stumbled to his side and gingerly wrapped an arm around him, led him toward the maintenance turbolift. He'd tried not to show the extent of his pain. Standing still was bad. Moving was worse. But had given up after a moment or two, leaning heavily on her. Somehow, she'd carried his weight. "Do you think," he'd asked, "anybody's listening?" He hadn't been able to raise an arm to point skyward after her transmission, but she'd seemed to understand. "I do," she'd said, soft and, to his ears, earnest. "Someone's out there." And she'd brought him into the turbo lift and supported him as he leaned against the metal wall. He was there now, one arm draped around Jin, feeling her impossibly frail and human form. He didn't know whether she was right. Didn't know whether, in fact, someone really was out there, or if the Empire had seized victory. As he turned the question over in his mind, he was surprised to realize he wasn't worried about the answer. Maybe it was his injuries. Hurt and exhaustion narrowed his reality, made it difficult to envision anything outside his sightline. When he thought about the people he cared about, the people who would have to carry on the fight against the Empire and the Death Star, the ones who hadn't volunteered to come to Scarif, he could picture no one. And that couldn't be right, could it? The more he thought about it, though, the less he believed the fog in his brain explained his lack of worry. He'd told Jin, "We've done terrible things on behalf of the Rebellion." Some he remembered now. Tivik, who'd made all this possible, and been rewarded with death. But most, to Cassian's shame, he couldn't bring to mind. He'd bartered his ideals and the lives of others away, one by one, to find a victory that would make it all worthwhile. Yet as he watched the pulsing lights of the turbo lift, he felt keenly that neither victory nor defeat would change the terrible things in his past. Jin couldn't give him what he'd come for. That was the crux of it, really. Because he'd given her what she needed, and he'd done the mission right, and he found that was enough. She believed someone was out there. Maybe it was even true. He did want it to be true. With all his heart, he did. Her faith carried him with her. He didn't say any of it. He didn't want to disturb the silence as they rested against each other, hurting and relaxed, listening to the hum of machinery and the distant billowing of fires. He stowed thoughts of old missions and thoughts of the future away, decided to focus on what he could see and hear and smell for the last moments of his life on Scarif. When Cassian Andor died, he would be ready, and he would be content. The Citadel had evacuated. Its officers and troops had panicked once they realized the Death Star's purpose. Jin didn't know that for sure, but it would explain why she and Cassian encountered no one on their departure from the tower, heard only distant shouts and the rumble of shuttles. If the shield gate was open, a few Imperials might possibly make it off-world before the end. She tried her comlink, just to see if anyone answered. No one did, which was as she'd expected. Even if there were shuttles left, she knew she wouldn't make it to a landing pad in time. Every step was an effort, and Cassian's grip was growing weaker. His strides faltered. She kept propping him up, but he was warm. And his breathing was regular, and it felt good to have life close to her. It wasn't at all like cradling Galen, who seemed apt to wash away in the rain as he died. Without anywhere better to go, she led them toward the beach. There had been beaches in Lamu, protected by jagged boulders, that had, to a child at least, seemed like mighty cliffs. She'd sent Stormy on harrowing adventures there, recounted them at night to her mother. Scarif's placid waters and white sands seemed a pale imitation of Lamu's grandeur. But they would have to do. They passed the body of a rebel soldier along the tree line. Jin positioned herself in Cassian's way so he wouldn't have to see. When they reached the beach itself, Cassian struggled with his footing in the sand. He dropped to both knees and Jin crouched beside him. They'd gone far enough, she decided. The breeze was clearing the air of ash and smoke, and they could no longer hear shouting. For an instant, Jin looked up, expecting against reason to see the glimmering of the rebel fleet among the stars. But of course, she couldn't see anything. The sky was blue and bright, and the only artificial construct in sight was the battle station. In all likelihood, the rebels had already fled, setting course away from Scarif the moment they'd received her transmission. Instead, she looked to Cassian. "I'm glad you came," she said. When the words finally touched him, he gently smiled and took her hand. She entwined her fingers with his so that they didn't drop away. The Death Star was pulsing with emerald light. Jin tried not to tense. She wasn't afraid of what would happen, but she didn't want to suffer. Somehow, she found herself closer to Cassian than before. Her breathing matched his, or his matched hers, deep and steady. The Death Star flared too bright to watch, and a tremor went through the beach. The placid waves rolled higher, spraying flecks of warm seawater over Jin's cheeks like tears. An unfathomable rumble echoed 10 or 1,000 kilometers away. "Your father would be proud of you," Cassian said, so soft Jin barely heard. She thought it was true, even though it wasn't why she'd come to Scarif. Not entirely, not really. It was good to hear aloud, from the lips of someone close. The rumbling overwhelmed all other sound. Jin tightened her grip on Cassian, and he found the strength to hold her. The world grew brighter, emerald at first, and then a clean, purifying white. In Jin's mind, the cave below the broken hatch was illuminated with the strength of a sun. And then the walls turned to dust, and there was no longer a cave, but only her spirit and heart, and everything she had ever been. The daughter of Galen and Lyra and Saw, the angry fighter and the shattered prisoner, and the champion and the friend. Soon all those things too burned away, and Jin Erso, finally at peace, became one with the Force.
Epilogue. The Imperial Star Destroyer Devastator cut through an ocean of ships and trailed a wake of burning gases and crackling particles. The light of Scarif reflected dully on the vessel's hull as it swung into the planet's gravity well, coursing toward the damaged Mon Calamari cruiser positioned above the Citadel. Darth Vader observed the chaos surrounding the Devastator and reordered it behind the red glow of his mask. He recognized the maneuvers of fighter squadrons on both sides, identified pilots who broke from their formations to better or worse effect. He saw the battle in microcosm and macrocosm, was instinctively aware of how each shot could contribute to ultimate victory or defeat. Yet only the cruiser concerned him. He made a single stroke of his hand as the enemy came into firing range. The ensuing echoes of turbo lasers were garbled static in his helmet. Streams of energy poured from the Devastator toward its foe, illuminating the darkness like lightning. Starfighters, friend and foe, caught between the two massive ships, suffered instant obliteration. The cruiser's shields shimmered with iridescence, then vanished in a flash. Fires flared along its port side as hull plating shattered or melted and venting oxygen combusted. The Rebel flagship is disabled, my lord. The Devastator's captain reported crisply at Vader's side. Darth Vader did not turn to him as he spoke. But it has received transmissions from the surface. Vader stared at the burning ship. There was death at play. Suffering and fear, yes. And something entirely different. Something that repelled his withered, agonized flesh.
Prepare a boarding party, he said.
Yes, my lord. The destruction of the Citadel, the lancing of Scarif with the Death Star superlaser, the evaporation of a sea, and the disintegration of archipelagos sent a tremor through Vader's shuttle as Vader and his squad rode to the flagship. Vader felt fear then, too, vast and powerful and purer than that which emanated from the cruiser. When his vessel reached the flagship and his stormtroopers burned their way through the hull, he started toward the rebel bridge and then pivoted. Perhaps instinct guided him. Perhaps something more. It did not occur to him to wonder. He sent his troops to continue on his prior path and moved on alone. The corridor lights flickered while alarms blared. Trapped in the blood-red chamber of his helmet, Vader was troubled by neither. He attuned himself to emanations of panic and desperation and followed their trail. When he encountered rebels reaching for their blasters or dashing to seal blast doors, he drew his weapon and cut them down with unhurried strokes of his crimson blade. The voice of a stormtrooper spoke to him through his comlink.
A data tape was recorded on the bridge just before we boarded. No sign of it here.
Vader did not answer, but he bolstered his pace.
He wound through the cruiser, leaving corpses behind him. He found his prey at last in a corridor thick with rebels backed against a security door.
As particle bolts shot toward him, he watched a data tape pass between desperate soldiers. He knocked the bolts aside with his blade, tore a blaster from one foe with a might that defied nature and gravity, and marched on. He delivered killing stroke after killing stroke, awakened and relentless. The security door opened a mere crack, and rebel hands shoved the tape through. Vader reached through life and matter and air, and by will alone, he pulled. He fueled his will with rage and fear and need. It was enough to tear the rebel from the door and drop him at Vader's feet. But it was not enough to claim the tape. He grasped the rebel sprawled before him by the throat, lifted him and stared at him through bloody lenses.
Where are they taking it?
The reply was a strangled whisper.
Away from here!
The rebel said.
Away from you!
Vader clenched his gloved hand until the man's neck snapped. Then he tossed the body aside. He activated his comlink and barked to his stormtroopers.
Find their escape vessel.
The prospect of failure crept over his skin like fire. The supremacy of the Death Star could not be jeopardized. The total obliteration of the rebellion remained possible. That it was in question at all was unthinkable. Darth Vader chased his quarry, seeking solace in the final triumph of the Emperor. The Tantive IV wasn't ready to fly, let alone fight. It had been the subject of frantic repairs during the lightspeed voyage from Yavin to Scarif. Secure in the hangar of the Profundity, where it had lain, stubbornly malingering since its last mission. Even after its host vessel had arrived in system and joined the battle against the Imperial Armada, Captain Ramus Antilles and his engineers and droids had worked desperately to make the Corvette spaceworthy, to seal the leak in its hyperdrive motivator and clean the buildup in its exhaust ports. Admiral Raddus had made the situation clear. Every ship in the fleet had a part to play. Ramus loved his ship. He'd nearly lost it once. For the Rebel Alliance, he would risk losing it again. But the battle over Scarif had ended before the Tantive IV could join the fray. Just as the Corvette's reactor had come to life, The profundity had screamed with punctured metal lungs. The Tantive forehead rocked in the hangar bay, nearly dislodging the boarding ramps clamped to its airlocks. Instead of ordering it to flee its burning host, Ramus had called for his crew to prepare for takeoff and then departed his own vessel. Under flickering emergency lights, breathing air thick with smoke and poison,